Deborah Granick is one of the most insightful and compassionate voices in contemporary American cinema, known for her deeply human storytelling and her ability to illuminate lives that are often overlooked. Deborah has created films that resonate with audiences long after the credits roll. Her work includes the Academy Award-nominated Winter's Bone, which launched Jennifer Lawrence's career, the critically acclaimed Leave No Trace, the documentary Stray Dog, and I can't forget about one of my personal favorites, Down to the Bone. Across both fiction and documentary filmmaking, she explores resilience, family, community, and the complex realities of life with a remarkable authenticity and empathy. Today, we're discussing her documentary, Conbody vs. Everybody, which follows former inmate Cos Marte, who launches the gym Conbody to help battle the high rate of recidivism in the U.S. It will be showing right here in Baltimore at the new Next Film Fest at the Charles Theater this Wednesday, July 15th. And Deborah, we are absolutely excited to have you here in Baltimore.
Oh, well, thank you for that beautiful welcome. And I'm excited. The project origins are Baltimore.
We're going to talk about that.
Yes. Okay.
First, let's chat about what Conbody versus Everybody is all about.
It's a film that follows the trajectory of, as you mentioned, Cos Marte, who, when he came out of incarceration in New York State, had some ideas in his mind. And he was facing the process of reentry, which is the first thing that hits you so hard after incarceration, which is, I've got this next journey in front of me, and there's no roadmap. And I have a very specific skill set now that feels different than when I went in. I'm not sure how to harness that or apply that. I don't know what my next move should be. I had loyalty and affiliations when I was a hustler on the street. Those are the things that come naturally to me, being very social person, very pro-social person. Mm-hmm. It was not lost on him that his attraction to staying fit while he was incarcerated was not at all unique. That was a tried and true method of sanity preservation and bodily strength preservation while being confined, while being subjected to very harsh circumstances. So these are the pieces that Cos was working with. And because he's really a bright bulb and he likes to put pieces together, that's where his business plan sort of erupted.
I know Cos has a story. You know, all of us have a story, right? But what was it about his story? What made you connect? What was it about his story that it came across your desk and caught your attention?
First of all, I'll say Cos's ability to code switch and tune in to who he's talking to was the olive branch I needed to say, oh, let's continue this conversation. We have an 11-block difference in a really huge metropolis, right? You're in the Lower East Side. I'm 11 blocks up at Union Square area. We have class and race differences, but you read me really well. And he expressed interest in the filmmaking side of things, in the chronicling and the storytelling side of things. Those were the signs I needed to say, like, I think this could be a very strong collaboration if he's down with it. And the other thing that caught me was he had spoken publicly at an event, at a reentry group. It was open to the public and I was there. And I just really appreciated the way he expressed himself. I really was moved by the way his dad happened to be in the setting. And he said something really specific and powerful to his father by route of making amends and talking about things like that openly. And I was like, this person is hungry for looking at what happens when he puts some honest, raw things out about himself. He said, I don't want to hide. I don't want to hide who I am. I thought that was very interesting to be bold about something where the inclination and the training and the socialization and the word on the street is like, hey, don't mention where you've been and what you've been through, especially if it involves a criminal record, you know?
True, very true indeed. And for someone in his situation who wants to tell a story and make sure that it's told in a way that he feels comfortable with, was it difficult to build his trust that you would do justice to his story or present it properly?
Cos is a savvy, he can vet people in a savvy way. And so I think he was always in that first year of working, you know, checking what story are they trying to tell? Are they looking for gotcha moments? I shared a lot of notes and the shot list, and we would meet with great frequency. And I would say, Cos, you've just mentioned these four things. I think they show really raw and interesting parts of reentry. Like you're trying to learn how to talk about your past. You're putting together these formal pitches to enter the business world and the startup arena. Mm-hmm. I think watching you do this and seeing you sort out what you're going to reveal and what you need to hold back, and even your style of presentation, what you choose to wear, the language and details you choose to use, all of this is part of a chronicling of your reentry. And so I think he was checking in with frequency. The trust was getting built by the fact that we had to confer, and I couldn't really make any moves without him. So everything is highly consensual in that sense. And then he immediately showed that he had producer chops as well. He's like, Deb, I think if you're going to shoot this, you're going to probably need me to ask permission, right? If you guys can be there. And I'm like, yes, yes. And so then he would always put, his best foot forward to ask in really appropriate ways whether some of the experience could be recorded, whether the film crew could be there. We were small. We were sound, camera, and me. So he got adept at sort of also, being able to pitch us well and say like, hey, this is a small, quiet crew. There's no extra lighting. Can they be in the room?
This sounds like a very good partnership in terms of him on his end, just really going above and beyond and being multifaceted in ways that really helped bring this whole project together.
Yes, Koss has those attributes and contributed them to the project.
Now, you, Deborah, as a filmmaker, how was it going from feature films to this multi-part series, Khan Body versus Everybody, and how much time you had to spend on the project?
Yeah, the time, I'm going to do time as part B. I'll do part A is the sliding between fiction narrative and then nonfiction narrative is often, I want to say, it's abundantly gift-giving, and it's head-banging at the same time. Because, I always have to reference Dickens, as a person who did really expansive urban novels about the times in which he lived. He was always looking at class and class experience and what was it like to be really working hard in the London ecosystem and not being paid adequately enough to survive safely. He looked at middle class people. He looked at people with of high worth and when were they generous and sharing their resources? When were they miserly and greedy? And just looking at all these interactions, I marvel at the complexity. Narrative nonfiction will give you a lot of Dickens type experiences at, especially in your off hours. You're like, wow, this really does relate to this. And this theme is a through line, and this keeps showing up. And of course, the story, the cast of characters will constantly expand. You meet someone like Klaus, and then a few days later, he says, I have a son, and I'm trying to do a really powerful reconnecting process with my son. I missed a lot of his pivotal years when I was incarcerated, his growing up years. I want to rebuild this. A few weeks after that, Koss is like, my brother and I took very different paths, but my brother seems to be showing signs of some interest in representing our community. I'm like, oh, well, I need to hear more about this. A few weeks after that, Koss's mom shows up to one of the exercise classes. And so his cast of characters expands. Then he brings on some other people that he connected with inside, that some of the guys that he used to run with start to enter the story. They bring on friends. They might have siblings or parents that become a part of the story. So that's where the nonfiction starts to build a cast of characters that I think Dickens or anyone else like any other social realist novelist would say, like, wow.
Yeah, Sarah, what a ride. Like, what an exciting ride just coming across these host of characters.
That's the gift and that's the headbanger. That's the overwhelm because the story starts to expand. I don't want to say I'm using the math term exponentially. But you get the idea that it starts to expand sort of faster than you might know how to shape it or contain it or figure out the right amount of details that a film can hold.
Right, because I guess you have to ask yourself at some point, when is enough enough? And how much can we really fit into this project?
And that leads us to time, your second, your aspect of your question, time. And I want to say breadth or girth, if you will. A novel can hold so much more than a film. Film can't have all these asides. Film hard forks too easily. A novel, I want to call them, have so many tendrils, and it can be as many pages as you need. It's depending on your reader. And you can have For example, many, many, many chapters, and the reader can pace themselves. A film, you have to make a very hard choice. Is it a single sitting? Is it a 2 hour, under 2 hours to two, approximately 2 hours single sitting and experience? Or is it with the advent of streaming and what we call, you know, mini series? Is it something that has a kind of serial or novelistic quality? But still, within that, the chapters are limited in the time. This was longitudinal. It turned out very quickly. COS wasn't going to perform reentry in a year. No such thing. Minimum 5 years. But then when you add the other people that he brought onto his team, the family he built of other people coming out of prison, it became more like 7, 8. Pandemic happened. COS is like, what? You're going to stop shooting during the most high stakes time of our lives?
Wow.
I don't think so. You got to at least finish what you started. So that became closer to the decade of recording and filming. And then the decision to apportion the story or tell it in these chapter segments. And we ended up on 5 chapters. They're a little over an hour, with the finale chapter being more like an hour and 20 minutes, if you will, because that chapter needed to squeeze a lot of time.
Wow, almost a decade of yep. your career going toward this project.
Yes. In the middle, we did pivot to a fiction film that was shot out on the West Coast, on the Pacific Northwest, called Leave No Trace. So there was a year, 2017, where we had a hiatus in most of the activity here in New York mm-hmm. with its chronicling. COS, however, kept me informed. And then as soon as shooting in Portland was done, we were able to meet some of the new people that COS had brought onto the team. And he was able to catch me up a bit about what needed to be filmed.
Now, early on, we mentioned there was a Baltimore connection to this project, Con Body versus Everybody. Tell me more about that connection.
Yes, with pleasure, because the research that went on in Baltimore was life-changing and unforgettable. So around, I would say, after Winter's Bone, let's talk about maybe like 2011 era, I had gotten very immersed in a fictional script that looked at maybe almost, I want to say, a couple years after The Wire, right? Which is something that left a huge indelible mark on Baltimore and then put Baltimore into the national psyche for a lot of years, mm-hmm. Brought out a lot of fresh talent in the acting community, and told a wake-up story to the United States about what street hustles really were in terms of multiple facets, whereas the sordid and the dark and the ultra-violent was sort of the only thing people knew, mm-hmm. and the creators of The Wire and the collaborators wanted to expand that understanding of what policing could be, what it was, what law enforcement, and why the U.S. has always had the largest drug markets in the world, the world's ever known, and trying to peer into that. You know, it didn't answer that, but it wanted to look at that. So Baltimore was a very fertile place of experts, people who had experienced incarceration, people who had gotten jammed up for working in black markets or drug markets, illegal hustles. They were also people who were extremely versed in reentry. What was it like to try to make your way? And what was it really like to come out of prison and not be able to get a living wage that would allow you to have a tenable life, to take care of maybe the seniors in your life or the very young people in your life that you were financially responsible for? How to live safely, really, right? To have enough nutrition in your household, that those kind of really core things. If you can't get employment that can cover those things, the likelihood of returning to a hustle that can support those things becomes higher, right? And so the math was very naked in Baltimore, and people were really good at proving that. And then in the travels in East Baltimore, as we did some videotaping and some skits and some rehearsals and some workshops, one other really important, the real shattering, exciting truth was people who got out and stayed out. The recidivism story is much more familiar to the average American, and I was in that cohort of a person who's not justice involved, who understood fully from documentaries, literature, and the great scholarship that was going on in that period, the likes of Michelle Alexander and other scholars who were explaining what mass incarceration was, et cetera. So I was aware of the problems with the American carceral system. I just wasn't understanding all the adjacent stories, like how does a person get out and stay out? Mm-hmm. And there was a guide who was willing to like talk about that. He was willing to talk about what it was like to get rid of some of the bling that had been associated with this street hustle. He was able to talk really beautifully about the PTSD that happens when you have a street hustle. You know, you are making money, but retaining that money is a frightfully high stakes, health damaging affair. with real life threats, threats to your family, your children, your safety. And the tenure of that money in your life is really problematic. Like that money often doesn't stay that, so it's not a stable source of income, and members of your family pay with their lives. So he was just a really great font of knowledge and firsthand experience. And he was the foundation for the research. I was like, I don't live in Baltimore. It's going to be really hard for me to continue to make this work in Baltimore. I need to go back up to New York. And what Baltimore did was give me the insight I needed to like knock on some doors in New York and carry on the project. So the origins are BMore and the sister city, New York. There's a lot of continuum, right? Where if you're incarcerated on the East Coast, if you've survived any of the urban, you know, a section of Baltimore, Philly, New York, Boston, it doesn't matter which of the cities on the East Coast, you can go south, you can go far north. If you've survived a street hustle, if you've survived incarceration, the commonality between people is pretty high in terms of savviness, what you need to know, and the very real needs you have when you come home to
Absolutely.
Get a second chance, which we know and which street informants will say is the first chance, right? So many people never, ever got a first chance at an education that's worth anything, a safe living situation, nutrition that was valuable, role modeling that was valuable. So if you didn't get that first chance, some people will say, costs and others, some of those first chances are acquired in prison. That's a brutal reality of the United States. What does it say about our country that your first chances are often in the inhospitable conditions of incarceration? But for any state that's got, that offers BA, you know, any kind of educational experiences in prison, not cheap soft skills that don't work, but like real stuff, that's pretty invaluable. If you get clean the first time ever in prison, and it's a really meaningful form of rehabilitation and knowledge about what chemical dependency is, that's a real plus. If you develop physical hygiene and health practices that can serve you for the rest of your life, that's a plus. But that doesn't happen across the board. That's a streak of luck if it happens, and your facility and the wardens in your state have to want that to happen, and the funding has to be there. You know, so there's a lot of ifs. However, really what you're looking at with reentry is the opportunity for a first chance. We call it a second chance because that makes it palatable to the American public. But if we're talking about real class issues in the United States and real opportunity and how those are racialized, we're talking about first chances.
Wow.
And so both the Baltimore lived experience and the New York lived experience, that's where one must go to hear it, to understand it. And then a filmmaker is very lucky if they're going to find people with that firsthand experience who want to then make that public and shareable and communicate it.
Deborah, just listening to, you know, how you came to Baltimore and took these stories in, really heard them, and even the subjects of your films and your projects, whether it's fictional or nonfiction, it seems like one of the through lines of your work are characters or people that are struggling on the fringes of society. What is it about your own experience or your own story that draws you to people that are in these sorts of positions and their stories?
They say, I don't know if this is hooey, but they say there's a gene that you're born with that filmmakers, it's a metaphor, but you know, this sort of extreme curiosity, right? And the curiosity is linked to, I think, relational feelings towards people, which is, how are you faring? How are you doing? How are you going to make it? Are you okay? Right? So it's like, it must be something that also gets fostered in one's family, right? You must, I saw role models of people, my elders, who cared a lot about how people next to them were faring. And when things appeared to be very beguiling about survival, how are you going to handle that? What are the resources that are available to you? And then when you find people who have, for whatever reason, a certain kind of resiliency, you feel a kind of awe and affection. And that plays out in my life all the time. So for a person like Koss, he has this trait that I am very drawn to all the time, which is the ability to withstand setbacks. It turns out, no surprise, that that's actually, when sociologists study who succeeds in reentry and who can make it to these important benchmarks that you need to not return to prison, one of the biggest, I want to say, mental tenacities, if you will, is the ability to withstand setbacks. And I really appreciate and get really struck by people who demonstrate this. And I always want to know, how are you doing this? What's going through your mind? And so I'm very drawn, and that's where the filmmaking comes in. What would it take to try to depict or portray a person like this, either a real life person or a fictional character who's infused with these traits? And I think that's really where that impulse comes from in the filmmaking.
And
That was a long answer.
well, it was the right answer, because it was your true answer, and it really helps those who follow your work to understand how you're able to just tell these stories in the way that you do. And I, you know, me just as someone who follows your work, there is a talent, it's commendable. Maybe it's genetic, like you said, it's in the genes. It's in the genes. You know, people who have these stories that are unheard, untold, they need people like you to come through and really hear them and be able to tell their stories in a way that honors their experiences and their journeys.
Oh, well, I want to just give a plug to a whole school of thought that's out there in the filmmaking world. It's the Danish nonfiction posse. You know, the Danish filmmaking community, fiction and nonfiction, always throws some real intense things into the global community, just some challenges, some interesting provocations. They've always been really interesting that way. And the Danish nonfiction community, one of the points they made a couple years ago, which I thought was fairly provocative, was the art of nonfiction. That's a term they use because they believe in very expansive definitions of nonfiction, you know, which would include like essay filmmaking and some of the terms that are a little rarer in the United States. But one of the things they said is that some nonfiction has been shrunken by commerce and corporate streaming to be this gotcha nonfiction, what we call true crime. And they're like, in the art of nonfiction, actually, we believe you're looking for the nobility in everyday life. You're looking for the nobility in everyday people. That's the art of nonfiction. It's not the gotcha. It's exposés in journalism must happen. And we know there are many unsavory and unethical human beings that walk the earth, and especially right now. And they need to be probed into. And gotcha is fair game because if you're doing heinous things, that needs to be exposed. But with most people, the and is in play. They have traits that are problematic, and they have very powerfully strong traits. And the nobility is to look for both and to make sure that both are included in the story. And so I just wanted to add that in, that some of this is not, you know, it's very, I'm part of a community, if you will, you know, of people that have like sort of like-minded practices. So I wanted to throw that in just to make people aware that nonfiction filmmaking can be a whole lot more than what the US marketplace would have us believe right now. Yeah.
Very interesting and really perfect. We could wrap it up right there, but I have one more question. I feel like it's a bit off topic, but I'm asking as someone who as a fan and someone who follows your work. Tell me about your relationship with Anne Rossellini, because to me, she has been a constant in all of your projects, including Kahn Body versus Everybody. So to me, you two are like a dynamic duo. So tell me about that years-long relationship with you and Anne Rossellini.
Yes. Anne was someone who did something very wonderful for my filmmaking trajectory early on, which was she's based on the West Coast in the Seattle area, had run a very beautiful short film festival for years in the Seattle area, and had taken a shine to a short I had made called Snake Feed and had programmed it, and then really made very meaningful contact with me and, you know, really talked about why she resonated with the film. And mentioned that she was going to try a stint living on the East Coast. She was going to come to New York. She'd been curious about what filmmaking might be like out here and wanted to try it. And so I like to tell the story because it's just maybe a good symbol. I believe it was 2 days after 9/11. This is going back some years now. And nobody was coming to New York. I think she was on the first flight that resumed, like being able to land in the city. In the land of New York, and she was there, and I was like incredulous, and she's like, I'm down. Let's pursue the script that you have that kind of grew out of Snake Feed, which was down to the bone. She's like, we could wait a lot of years for people to green light us. We could wait a lot of years for people to tell us what kind of bankable, financeable talent needs to be in this film. But if you're down with making something scrappy and with the resources we happen to have, which is a handy cam and some of your buddies from film school, let's do it. So Anne's moxie was really powerful and incisive in my filmmaking process. And so we partnered up back then. And you're right, we've stayed partners. And she is always asking a really, really good question. I think other filmmakers might really appreciate this question that Anne asks. Anne's like, how can we pursue this life of filmmaking and not have it shred us and destroy us? Because it can. And she's like, oh, how could a film shoot be fun? Is there any chance that we, you know, she looks at other cultures again and asks, you know, the French seem to actually sometimes enjoy some of their days out in the field. You know, what could we do to make that happen? And she raises those questions about the psychoethical aspects of filmmaking. And she's just been a really great partner to have these years. And yes, so I like to think of us as a duo. And she did live on the East Coast for a whole decade and then moved back. So we have now a long distance partnership, but we're going to make more films.
I love that.
By hook or by crook, you know.
I love it.
She's just, her request is that they don't take quite as long as Con Body. That's not good.
Well, a decade, that is a lot of time.
Yeah. So we're going to try to work on like bringing things down to like a more feasible time frame. And then the other part I just want to mention, just because it's so important for Con Body, is our editing partner, Victoria Stewart, who edited all of Con Body. And most people, especially other editors who ever hear this, most people know when you have 400 hours of footage over 8+ years, Oof. And you're one editor, that's a powerful achievement. So I just like to shout out what that means to be a person who can keep that many images and experiences in an archive, in a library, and then retrieve them and build a story from them. You know, that's something.
Absolutely. A dynamic team. Deborah Granick, thank you so much for taking the time. I know you were in the edit room yesterday. I know you're at work, but just taking this time with us. Your latest documentary, Con Body versus Everybody, it will be showing here in Baltimore at the New Next Film Fest at the Charles Theater Wednesday, July 15th. I will be there. There's going to be a Q&A, so folks will get a chance to chat it up with you as I have, and I've thoroughly enjoyed myself. So thank you so much for taking the time with me today.
You're so welcome. And I really enjoyed our conversation, and see you next week.